From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We didn't know the consequences until later. And if I had known that I risked being tortured or that my children could be tortured in front of me, I would have not done it. But I didn't know. I wasn't very aware. And what I did then was trying to smuggle information out of the country, hide people in my house and elsewhere, and find asylum for people who were in desperate need to get out of the country.
Today, an hour with Isabel Allende, the great writer, author of House of the Spirits, Paula, and so many other books. Also godniece of Chilean President Salvador Allende. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Pentagon study suggests that a drug that was given to protect soldiers from nerve gas may be linked to a range of symptoms associated with Gulf War syndrome. Findings from the Pentagon Finance study will be presented today. The review of 1,000 studies on the drug known as PB finds the drug cannot be ruled out as a cause of lingering illness in some Gulf War vets. Since the war, some vets have suffered from a range of symptoms, including chronic pain, digestive problems, skin rashes, fatigue, aching joints, memory loss, and concentration problems. However, an assistant secretary of defense tells today's Los Angeles Times the military will continue using PB. For years now, veterans have alleged that they believe that the vaccination they were forced to take against nerve gas was a cause of their symptoms. The Pentagon has long denied it. This news from East Timor, the shattered city of Dili, is too preoccupied with the slow struggle of getting back on its feet today to pay much attention to Jakarta's decision to give East Timor its independence. Most East Timorese regard the day the UN-backed international force arrived in the territory to end a campaign of violence by pro-Jakarta militiamen and the Indonesian military as the moment their independence was secured after almost a quarter a century of brutal Indonesian rule. Indonesia's top legislature is due to formally ratify the results of the UN-run August vote, in which almost 80% of East Timor's voters opted for independence. Today's vote is largely a formality. After all, 11 factions in the assembly yesterday agreed to endorse the result. Hillary Rodham Clinton called yesterday for an immediate and permanent end to the use of a Puerto Rican island as a Navy target range. The First Lady's comments came the same day a Pentagon panel working at the direction of her husband recommended Navy bombing be allowed to resume on Vieques Island, but that use of the facility be phased out over 5 years. Sentiment against the Navy's use of Vieques has been growing in Puerto Rico since a bombing accident in April killed a civilian security guard. Protesters have been camping out on the bombing range since then, but the Navy has been eager to resume using it. A new biography of George W. Bush claims he was busted for cocaine in 1972, but that his father pulled strings to get his record expunged, a bombshell flatly denied by the candidate and a former prosecutor. Fortunate Son is by J.H. Hatfield. It quotes unidentified sources saying the elder Bush worked out a backroom deal with a judge for his son to perform community service in exchange for purging records of the arrest. The book, published yesterday by St. Martin's Press, does not provide any documentation or specifics, including a time or place for the arrest or the name of the Republican judge supposedly involved. The Texas governor said it never happened, and he was backed up by Carol Vance, a Texas lawyer who was Harris County's Democratic district attorney in 1972. The UN Security Council is focusing on the increase in global terrorism with a fresh call for international cooperation to prevent terrorist attacks and to bring perpetrators to justice. Against a backdrop of recent bombings and killings from Russia and Kosovo to East Timor and Burundi, the Council's holding an open meeting today to adopt a resolution renewing the United Nations' commitment to combat terrorism. If white South Africans are sorry for atrocities committed under apartheid, not many are saying so. Just a few hundred people have signed a register expressing regret at failing to prevent human rights violations under apartheid. And the issue of redress for those who suffered seems to have slipped off the public agenda. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a panel set up to look into apartheid-era abuses, started a Register of Reconciliation in 1997 for people to convey their remorse and commit themselves to reconciliation. Overall, remorse has been slow in coming from white political leaders and major institutions. And the Food and Drug Administration wants to know what you think about bioengineered food. Controversy surrounding the use of genetically engineered food products is growing so strong that the agency is scheduling an unprecedented series of public meetings on the issue. European countries already refuse to accept biotechnologically engineered foods, and now U.S. critics are insisting they be labeled. The meetings will be in Chicago, Washington, and Oakland, California, over the next 2 months.
Ni por tener buena voz, canto porque la guitarra tiene sentido y razón, tiene corazón de tierra y alas de palomino.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. And as you know, for the last months, we have been covering the Pinochet case and getting reaction from people around the world who are not giving us abstract analysis, but who speak from their own lives, their own experience, their own hearts. Just a few months ago, the hour we spent with Joan Hatta, the widow of Victor Hatta, and then speaking with people whose sons, who themselves were taken, whose daughters, whose fathers, whose family members, they were victims of the Pinochet regime. Today, we have a special guest in the studio. She is a great writer, and many people don't really quite understand what her relation is to a man whose name she also shares, often saying she's his daughter, his wife, his grandmother, his great-granddaughter. We've heard it all. She has just written another book. It is called Daughter of Fortune. Her name is Isabel Allende, and I know everyone's going, oh, my God. Call the boss, tell him I'm going to be late. And don't worry, we will give you late excuses for your work today. But Isabel Allende is with us, and we thank you very much for joining us. It is a great honor to have you on Democracy Now!
It's a pleasure, to be here and an honor.
Well, the latest news we have out of Chile just from this weekend is that police arrested 58 people, including four army officers in plain clothes, during protests on the year anniversary of General Augusto Pinochet's arrest in London. Can you tell us your connection to the Pinochet years? Can you tell us your experience of them?
Well, I'm related to the Allende family. My father was Tomás Allende. He was first cousin of Salvador Allende. And my stepfather was a very good friend of Allende. So we were very close. The families were very close. And the day of the coup, I saw the bombing of the palace, and I learned that Allende had been killed, and that there was a plane that the Mexican government had sent to offer asylum for all the family and the closest friends of Allende. And I stayed in Chile. I didn't take that plane because I thought that we had such a long tradition in democracy that it couldn't last. I mean, a coup in Chile was unthinkable. We couldn't possibly imagine that it would last more than a week. It lasted 17 years. In the meantime, of course, a million Chileans left the country, and I was among them with my husband and my children. And I lived in Venezuela in exile for 13 years. I never thought that we would see Pinochet arrested or the impunity of the military challenged in Chile. I was talking to an Argentinian a week ago, and he said, for 25 years, we have had a feeling of defeat. And that was lifted from our shoulders when Pinochet was arrested. And he's an Argentinian. It is the feeling that in all of Latin America something happened, the sense that there is no impunity anymore. And I think that that is very important. On the other hand, from the perspective of a Chilean person, how can you expect reconciliation or healing without the truth? Just ignoring what happened, hiding it. It is impossible. This was like the Holocaust, something that marked the country. You have to deal with it. And I think that the people who were the victims and the people who were the victimizers need to deal with it.
What is your reaction to those who are talking about, here you have this 83-year-old man, he's quite sick, he's right now in England. Many feel that even if he wins, even if Spain wins the case to get him extradited, he won't ultimately go there, that he must be considered on grounds of compassion.
It would be very ironic if that would happen, that for humanitarian reasons he would be sent back to Chile. But it may happen. The importance of the trial, either in Chile or in Spain or anywhere, is that finally the truth is exposed. And that's the whole point. Nobody wants to rape the rapist, kill the killer, torture the torturer. That's not the point. It's not revenge is not the point. The point is the truth. And a trial means that you can expose it and publish it. And in that way, honor the suffering of the people who suffered.
Isabel Allende, although you did leave and went into exile, you did stay in Chile for a period of time, for more than a year, is
yes.
that right, when Pinochet rose to power. Can you talk about what you did then?
I did what many people did. I think that I tried to help the people who were the direct victims of repression. We didn't know the consequences until later. And if I had known that I risked being tortured or that my children could be tortured in front of me, I would have not done it. But I didn't know. I wasn't very aware. And what I did then was trying to smuggle information out of the country, hide people in my house and elsewhere, and find asylum for people who were in desperate need to get out of the country.
In, I think it was Paula, in your book, Paula, you talk about your flowered little car, which certainly stood out, and it would drive through the streets of Chile. You would drive it through Santiago, helping people.
Yes, it was very visible. I think that indicates how little I knew of the risks. Then when I realized what I was risking, and I realized also that I could not back off, I left. I just couldn't take the fear.
And your family left, followed
yes.
you. But you also did write at that time. You wrote a play called The Ambassador?
No, that was before. That was during Allende's time. And I had several jobs. I was fired from some. I had to quit others. And it was a hard time, but we were doing well economically because my husband was an engineer, and he had a very good job. So we were not among those who left Chile for economic reasons, because at the time of the coup, many people lost their jobs, and many left because they could not survive. But it wasn't our case. We left for political reasons.
Of Love and Shadows documents one of the massacres in Chile. You base it on a journalist, a fictional figure, but can you talk about your own work gathering the information for that, which was both real and not real? As you often say, the truth might come more from fiction than from nonfiction.
Of Love and Shadows is based on a case that happened in Chile during the coup. They arrested 15 peasants, and they killed them. They disappeared. 5 years later, in 1978, they found the bodies in an abandoned mine. I was living in Venezuela at the time. And when I learned about this case, I became obsessed, totally obsessed with the case, as if the ghosts of those peasants were haunting me. I was not a writer then, and I was not a journalist in Venezuela. So I just kept the story inside me, but I gathered all the research I could. And when I finished The House of the Spirits, I realized I had to start another book before panic would take over, because the first book was so successful that I would have panicked if I didn't start immediately the second one. I didn't have to think the story, because I had the story. It was that story. And in that book, I mixed my own personal experience as a young journalist in Chile during the time of the repression, when we were living in uncertainty, in a sort of world that seemed normal in appearance, while under the surface there was all this horror going on. And many people managed to ignore it and go on with their lives. I couldn't do that, and most journalists could not, because we had the information. As journalists, we knew what was going on, but we couldn't publish it, of course. There was censorship and self-censorship and terror, so we couldn't. And I mixed that with a real story of the of these peasants that disappeared and were found in the mine.
And the reporter who investigated them, Irene Beltran?
The reporter is based on some of my friends. She's like, she's part of me, of what I did, and part of some of my friends who did what Irene did.
And you risked your life at that time, just whether you understood it or not, gathering the, before you wrote the book, when you were still in Chile, gathering the testimonies of people.
Yes. At the time in Chile, for example, one of the things that I recorded was the testimony of people who had been recently tortured. And the last chapter, one of the last chapters of The House of the Spirits, the chapter of terror, is based on those recordings. Of course, all that was forbidden. You couldn't record those things. But I smuggled that those tapes out of the country. I sent them to Germany at the time. And then I had copies. And when I wrote The House of the Spirits, I had the information. And for Of Love and Shadows as well.
Isabel Allende, you've spoken of and written about how you came from a privileged class in Chile. And you just mentioned how you just couldn't believe that Pinochet could rise to power. But what do you think kept the silence for so long of the privileged class, and how has that affected your work and what you write about?
I think that that creeps into everything I work, everything I write. It's the day of the military coup, I think that I woke up. I had been like a very long adolescent for too long. I had been innocent in many ways. And that day I realized that there was a dimension of cruelty and violence that is always there. And I had failed to see it. But it had been there before. It is impossible that we would have torture centers and concentration camps all over the country in 24 hours. That we would have people torturing with this technology for torturing all of a sudden in 24 hours. That was there, waiting in the shadows, and we failed to see it. And so that changed me as a person. It ended the age of innocence for me, and I became another person. And I think that I write because of that. I have to thank Pinochet, an exile, for my writing. I would not have the need to write if I did not have this confusion inside me and this permanent need to sort out that confusion, to understand how we are as human beings, how contradictory and complex, how much evil and how much goodness we have inside. I feel that I have been a very lucky person because I have never had to exercise that evilness that I know that we all have as human beings. I have been so privileged and so lucky that I can be a good person. But who knows what I would do if I was terrified, really? What I would do if I saw my children at risk? I don't know. Or if I was brainwashed and trained to do something horrible. Because I'm sure that some of those young soldiers that tortured were trained for that. They were not particularly evil. They were brainwashed. They were convinced that if they didn't do it, it would be done to them, that if they shared the bloodshed, they would have impunity, that were receiving orders, that they were doing it for the fatherland. Who knows how they do it? But these are young, vulnerable people who are trained to do something horrible. I was trained to do something better than that, so I'm lucky.
What you think are the political responsibilities you have now as a writer who has become so prominent? Do you feel that you have political responsibilities?
Yes. Since the military coup, I have always felt the responsibility of my name, first of all, of carrying my name with a sense of dignity and responsibility. And then because I find myself in front of a microphone or an audience very often, I feel that I have the responsibility to tell people what happened, to keep that event alive in the memory of younger people who maybe have no idea of what happened 25 years ago. And I have a responsibility in the United States. I speak English and I speak Spanish. I can be a bridge between both cultures. I can speak for the immigrants and tell the whites that there's nothing to be afraid of. We're just people. I also find the responsibility of saying to the American public what the CIA has done abroad and is still doing sometimes, how they have supported and financed the kind of brutal regime abroad that they would never tolerate in this country, and how with the taxes of the American people, the CIA has financed wars, torture centers, concentration camps, massacres, military coups, and even drugs. And I think that it is important that people denounce this.
Do you see the people of this country who are silent about this in the same way you saw the privileged class that you were a part of in Chile?
I think that in order to live with something that is unpleasant, we tend to ignore it. And I find myself ignoring the homeless. When I drive along Van Ness, for example, in San Francisco, and I see a homeless person in every single corner in the street, I ignore it. Because if I acknowledge it, I have to get involved. And I think that that is a sort of defense mechanism that we all have. But I think that the more we talk about it, the more we act against it. And I think that the American public is basically very honest. I find that people are much more generous and compassionate. Very generous. If there is a catastrophe anywhere, people in the United States will give money and they will give their time and they will volunteer and they get involved as soon as they are touched by something. So I think that it is important to spread the news.
We're talking to Isabel Allende, the author of House of the Spirits, Paula, of Love and Shadows, and so much more, one of the great writers in the world today. We'll be back with her in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Isabel Allende, who is one of the great writers in the world today. And I know it's hard for you to hear that term, writer. As you were saying at the beginning of our conversation, you're just coming to terms with identifying yourself as a writer. Why is it so hard for you?
Because I feel that that the world is full of stories. And I'm a storyteller. I listen. I have a good ear for stories. And I listen to these stories, and I write them down. But they don't belong to me. I don't make them up most of the time. They just happen. They may have happened before, or maybe they are happening now, or maybe they will happen tomorrow. And I'm like a radio. I just tap into these waves and get the stories.
Can you tell us how you started writing your first book, House of the Spirits?
I was living in Venezuela. I could not find a job as a journalist. I felt that I was suffocating with all these stories inside me, all these unwritten words, all these thoughts and stuff that I had inside. And maybe I was just waiting for a very good excuse. And on January 8th, 1981, we received a phone call that my grandfather was dying. And I had promised my grandfather years before that I would help him die with dignity. He did not want to be hooked to machines or anything like that. And he was already very old, almost 100 years old. And I could not go back to Chile to bid him for farewell or to help him die as I had promised. And I started a sort of spiritual letter to tell him that he could die in peace, because I remembered all his stories, all his life, all the things he had told me, and I would preserve them. So I started writing the first anecdote that he ever told me about the family, and that was about my great aunt Rosa, who was beautiful as a mermaid. And when I was a child, I thought mermaids had green hair. So I described a woman with green hair. I never met that great aunt, because she died poisoned in very mysterious way, circumstances, long before I was born. And then my grandfather died, and I kept on writing. I couldn't stop. Of course, I had a day job. I worked 12 hours a day, so I would write in the kitchen at night in a little portable typewriter. By the end of the year, I had 500 pages in the kitchen, and I thought, this doesn't look like a letter anymore, and there's no one to send the letter to. And I gave it to my mother, and my mother said, I don't know, but this stuff looks like a book to me. And so she went around offering it to some publishers. Nobody wanted to read it, or let alone publish it. And then somebody said that I should find an agent. I didn't know that agents for literature existed. I thought that they were only for sports. And so I found an agent eventually, and she said, okay, I'll take it. And in 3 months, the book was published in Europe, and all the European publishers were buying the translation. It was just one of those success stories that are like unbelievable. And I was very lucky, because that really paved the way for all the other books.
In all of your books, there are powerful women, starting with House of the Spirits.
Do you know any women that are not powerful? I've been looking for women that are not powerful.
Well, you're right, except that I know many books where there aren't powerful women.
Written by men.
That's right. But the four women in House of the Spirits, who are they? Who are they based on?
They're based on my great-grandmother, my grandmother, my mother, and a generation of women my age, although Alba is not me, but she's based on many women of my generation who went through the things that Alba went through. But many of the characters in the House of the Spirits are loosely based on my family, but maybe not that loosely, because some of my relatives don't speak to me.
Has that been a problem? As a result of your writing, has it caused rifts in your family?
Yes. My maternal family is very conservative, and for them, I write pornography, and I'm a communist, so they don't like me. Some people don't, of course, in the family, but other people do. Other people feel that somehow the House of the Spirits is like the story, the official story of the family. But it's very funny, because when the movie was released, then the fiction of the movie is so much more powerful than any book, that now the photographs of Meryl Streep and Jeremy Irons are on the pianos of some of my relatives instead of my grandfather and my grandmother, you know. So I have these Anglo blue-eyed grandparents now.
One of the characters in your book, House of the Spirits, was based on Pablo Neruda. You talk about him as the most widely translated poet in the world, his name in the book, Pedro Tercera. And in fact, you attended his funeral, and he had a major influence on your life and your writing. Can you talk a little about him and how he shaped it?
As I said before, my stepfather was a diplomat, and I think I said it, and we traveled extensively all my life. I was traveling all my youth. And we would carry Pablo Neruda's books, and we would read it aloud at home, because for us it represented Chile. It was like a description of Chile as we thought it should be, or it was. Then you go back to Chile, and it's not exactly like the description of Neruda, but anyhow, that is what Chile was for us. So he's a big literary influence, I think, for me, because when I'm looking for an unusual adjective or for a description of something, I go to Neruda always. But also, when I was living in Chile in 1973, Neruda was already very sick. He returned from France, where he was a diplomat, and he returned to Chile. And he was living in the coast in a little place called Isla Negra. And one day he invited me to his house, and I thought he wanted me to interview him. I was a journalist then. And I was so proud. I thought, the Nobel Prize wants me to interview him. Oh, my God. I bought a new tape recorder. I washed the car, and I drove all the way to Isla Negra. And he invited me for lunch, and he showed me his wonderful collections of all kinds of objects, bottles, figureheads, shells, paintings, books. He collected everything. And then after lunch, it was winter, a very windy, cold day, and I said, well, Don Pablo, I will have to be leaving soon. I'm ready for the interview. And he said, interview? What interview? And I said, well, I came to interview. He said, I would never allow you to interview my child. You are the worst journalist in this country. You lie all the time. You put yourself in the middle of everything. You can never be objective. And I'm sure that if you do not have a story, you make it up. Why don't you switch to literature, where all these defects are virtues? I thought at the time that that was the beginning of Alzheimer's or something. But but many years later, I remembered that. And when I find myself lying bluntly in fiction, I always think that through those lies, I reach some kind of truth.
Isabel Allende is our guest, the great author who has written so many books that have helped us all grow up or understand ourselves or become more confused. The House of the Spirits, of Love and Shadows, Eva Luna and the Stories of Eva Luna. The very painful book about her own daughter, Paula, which is called Paula, which also tells us the story of Isabel Allende. And then her most recent book, which has just been published, called Daughter of Fortune. But before we get to Daughter of Fortune, I wanted to spend a little time talking about Paula, which was such a powerful book. Very much your own experience, though, as you say, you can't get away from fiction in anything you do. But I found that silence is a major force in your writing also, the power of silence and House of Spirits and beyond. And I thought it was interesting, although and very painful, that in fact that is what in the end your daughter succumbed to, having gone into a coma, and you spending all this time with the daughter that you spoke to her whole life growing up, then not being able to at least hear from her, though you spoke to her right to the end. Can you talk a little about what happened to Paula?
Paula had a very rare condition called porphyria, which should not be fatal. But there was a series of mistakes and negligence in the hospital in Madrid, and she fell in a coma. The coma was not properly monitored, and her fluids plummeted. She didn't receive enough oxygen, and that produced severe brain damage. I was not told that this had happened, and the doctors kept on telling her husband and me that she would recover completely. So we waited and waited. And I think that Ernesto would agree with me that if they would have told us at the beginning, we would have disconnected her, because we knew both that Paula would have not wanted to live in that condition. And we would have avoided a year of pain, very, very much suffering for her. But it didn't happen that way. And when eventually we demanded a scanner and they told us that she had severe brain damage and she would never be able, she was in a vegetative state, she would not recover at all. Then we disconnected her and she started breathing, and we brought her to California where I live, and I took care of her at home. And it was a horrible experience and a wonderful time, because Paula was like a newborn baby. I would say less than a newborn baby, because she couldn't even eat. She had to be fed through a tube in the stomach. But she went back to the womb somehow. She became this totally dependent little baby that I tried to keep as comfortable and as happiness as possible in that condition as possible. And I never interrupted the communication with her. I always talked to her, and I wrote to her.
How did you start writing in the hospital?
At the beginning in the hospital, I thought she was going to wake up. Because I thought that Paula was going to wake up one day, a nurse or somebody told me that usually patients who have been in a coma, when they wake up, they have loss of memory and they don't remember anything about the present or the past. And so I started writing to her a sort of journal to tell her who she was and who were all these people around her bed, who was Ernesto, who loved her so dearly, and all of us. And in the process of writing to her, I realized I was also writing a sort of memoir of my own life. I was trying to tell my daughter who I was and maybe justify some of the things I had done in my life that maybe may have hurt her so badly. I think that all parents make mistakes, but I have made more mistakes than most parents. So I just wanted to explain things to her and also explain to her why we had taken her out of Chile at a very early age, what had really happened. Because my children grew up in a foreign country without never really understanding why that had happened, why they were torn from their roots, from their grandparents, from a house where they were so happy as children. And they had to start it like a new life. They were too young to understand the political reasons or the political atmosphere in Chile at the time. And we had tried very badly to preserve them from the fear. And maybe that was not the right thing to do. So I tried to explain all that in that letter. Then, when I learned that she was never going to be able to read that letter, I went on writing because I couldn't stop. And by the end of the year when she died, my mother said, "You have to write. If you don't write, you will go crazy. Just start writing." My daughter died on January 6, 1992, and I started all my books on January 8th, so a month later, forced by my mother, really, I started rewriting all those notes that I had taken in the hospital, plus a bunch of letters that my mother gave back to me, the letters I had written to her during that year, because she said, "I want you to read them in chronological order so that you will know, remember exactly what happened and how fortunate Paula is that she died, because she could have remained in this state for 20 years. So it's a great thing that she died and she's liberated now."
In fact, the end of your book, the last line of your book,
it's about that. It's about welcoming her spirit.
And saying goodbye to her body.
Yeah. And I have made peace with that. This was several years ago, and I'm really, truly convinced that that she lives in the spirit and that I can connect with her in dreams, with imagination, with memory, with the love that some people have for her, and you wouldn't believe it, with letters that I receive every single day of my life, including Sundays, from all over the world. People who were touched by Paula's story, especially young women her age, who write to me. And I have this superstitious thing that sometimes, for example, I have a doubt about, let's say, something that is happening in the family. In normal times, I would have picked up the phone and called Paula, who was very wise, and asked her, "What should I do?" And she would have an answer. And now I have this superstitious thing that if I wait a week, I will get the answer. And it really happens. There's a letter that comes in the mail with someone telling me something that is somehow related to what my doubt is, and giving me some kind of solution. So I think that she is scattered in the world, in the souls of all these young women her age who feel for the first time confronted with mortality and with the fact that you have to live your life intensively and happily and joyfully and playfully because it's so short and because you don't know how short it will be. And so they have for the first time reading this book this feeling that it can be over in a minute. And they want love, the love that Paula had with Ernesto, and they want family, and they want to go back to their mothers and have a relationship with their mothers. And this is what they write to me about.
We're talking to Isabel Allende, the great writer of House of the Spirits, of Love and Shadows, Paula, the story of her daughter. Her latest book is Daughter of Fortune, which we'll talk about in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with Isabel Allende in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with the great writer, Isabel Allende.
Isabel Allende, you just mentioned your own mother and the important role that she has played in that book, but clearly through all of your life and your books. Can you talk about her?
Yeah, my mother, I've idealized her, and I'm always saying how wonderful she is, but she can also be a bitch, huh? And but I do love her, and we have a sort of very honest relationship. There is nothing in the world that I can't talk with my mother. Sometimes I have avoided certain things that might hurt her, but sooner or later I end up talking those things also with her. We are very close. I write to her every day, and she writes back. When she discovered the facts, she would write two or three times a day. So there was a point when I had to say, Mom, I don't even have time to read your letter. So just once a day is perfectly okay. We are really very connected.
And is it true she's your editor?
She is the person who reads my manuscripts and comes to me with the corrections and the suggestions and all. She's the person with whom I confront my book. I would say the only person, because by the time any of my publishers buy the book, it has already been published in Spanish, so they buy a translation. I do not have any editor in Spain. She's the only person who comments on my books.
You went from writing a book about your daughter Paula and your own self during that extremely painful period to writing Aphrodite, which is about food and sex. How did you make that transition?
Very consciously. After I finished Paula, I realized that I couldn't write. I was in a writer's block. I was very depressed. I was taking Prozac. I was in therapy. Many things happened because a year after my daughter died, that is by the time I finished writing that book, my husband's daughter died as well of an overdose. And so my family was mourning for a very long time, and my relationship with my husband was so sad. We didn't know how sad it was. We just thought that it wasn't working. And we were even talking about divorce at the time. And then we went to therapy, both of us. And the therapist, I remember in the first session, he said, "Oh my God, you seem so sad." And we both just burst crying. And we realized that sadness was what was interfering and not that we didn't get along or something. So a few years went by in which I couldn't write and he couldn't do anything. It was just awful. And then I remember that I'm a journalist, and if you give me a subject, I can write about almost anything. Well, not sports, but almost anything. So I gave myself a subject that would be as removed as possible from mourning. And I thought lust and gluttony, the only deadly sins that have some style. The rest is just evil and ruin. And I wrote what I thought was going to be an article. It ended up being a book. And it was a playful book, and the research was funny. And I did most of it in porn shops in the gay neighborhoods of San Francisco. So it was really fun.
Did most of what?
The research for the book. because it was about eroticism. I mean, food, you can find books about food everywhere, but there's not much about erotica, you know, there isn't much. So making the link between the cookbooks and the erotica, that was entertaining.
Did your mother help you do some of the research? Did you take her to some of the porn shops?
I took my mother once to one of the porn shops, and she was a little horrified, but it was worse when I had to translate into Spanish the instructions of all these rubber devices and all this vibrating machinery, because it looks like a machine.
Did this all help your relationship with your husband?
Not the machines, but... But the research for the book did. And actually, we've been together for 12 years, and today I was answering an interview on the phone, and the person said, well, how do you take all this traveling and all these things? And I said, well, I'm very well. I'm okay, because I carry my home with me. He is my home, really. And as long as he's around, I'm okay.
Let's talk about your latest book, Daughter of Fortune, which also is one of your later books. So it takes place partly in the United States, in California. First, I wanted to ask you if you still originally wrote it in Spanish.
Oh, I write only in Spanish. I can write a speech in English, but not fiction. Fiction is something that happens more in the womb than in the mind. And all the organic things I do in Spanish. I dream in Spanish. I make love in Spanish. I would feel ridiculous making love in English. And I cook in Spanish, and I write in Spanish.
So you wrote this book in Spanish?
Yes. I have a very good translator.
I've read some interviews of yours where you say that your great success is actually not due to your stories, but to your translators.
I think so, because, for example, my books are so popular in Germany, and I can only explain it because the translator improves them. And I think in English, she does too.
What do you think of the sex manuals being described in German?
Actually, that book wasn't that popular in Germany.
Well, what has it been like for you to make that transition, writing from your home in Latin America overall, whether it was Chile or Venezuela, to writing in the United States and remembering your home?
Actually, California is very Hispanic. And my husband speaks fluent Spanish, and we have put together a sort of extended Latin family in which half of the members are Americans, of course, and they don't even speak Spanish. But somehow we've put this thing together, and I feel that I still live in a very Latin American way. And California is a crazy place. I mean, talking about magic realism, you couldn't get more magic realism than California. Half of my friends are into crystals and all kinds of New Age stuff, and they take their pets to the therapist. I mean, you don't find that kind of stuff in Latin America. So I'm never short of stories. My problem is the language, that I speak Spanish without any of the irony, the subtleties, the playfulness of the words that you do in your own language in your own country, because here I speak the stiff translated Spanish or learned Spanish of my husband and my grandchildren and the few people who speak Spanish around me. So I miss the language terribly. And when I write, I find myself going more and more to read poetry in Spanish or the dictionary, because I'm losing the vocabulary. I'm losing the ease with which I wrote before.
Well, tell us about Daughter of Fortune and how you did the research for Daughter of Fortune.
In 1991, when I finished writing The Infinite Plan, which is the story of my husband, by the way, I married him to get the story. Well, and a green card, too, but mainly the story. The story is placed, of course, in California, because he's a California man. I was fascinated with the place, and I realized when I did the research for that book that San Francisco is only 150 years old. Before, there was a small Mormon colony, a few Indian tribes, and his Mexican haciendas, But people were not even immigrating there from the rest of the United States. They were going to Oregon or other places in the West, but not California, which was supposed to be a very wild land. And then the gold rush happened. They found the gold in January 1848. And in a matter of a year, thousands and thousands of young men went from all over the world to that place. And they created this society in which I would say the main characteristic is diversity. It is a place of diversity. You walk in the streets of San Francisco and you can smell all the food from all over the world. You can hear all the languages. You see all the races. And that is what makes that place so particular and so unique and wonderful. And I realized also that the gold rush, which was a time of greed and violence and racism and abuse of all kinds, was also a time of mad hopes, of idealism, of freedom, of people who went there with the idea of shedding the past and starting a new life, becoming a new person. And that was the feeling I had when I went to California. I remember exactly the first night I spent with Willie in Willie's house, and I was sitting in his bedroom alone, and I thought, I can invent a new self for this man. I can forget my past and leave behind all the suffering and all the losses and all the stupid things I've done, and I can invent a new person to be with this man. Of course, it never happens that way because you are within your skin and you carry with you yourself always. But you have that illusion for a moment, and I think that that is what brought many people to California, not only the gold, but the idea that there was a vast land that belonged to nobody, because California was not part of the Union yet. It was not part of the United States. And Mexico had just lost the war and had lost California. So it was a no man's land. And you could go there and be somebody else, escape from war, from poverty, from mediocrity, from yourself, maybe from a wife, who knows.
Well, you had your protagonist, Eliza Summers, going there to find her man, to hold on to the past.
Eliza Summers is 16 when she falls in love with Joaquin Andieta, and he comes to the gold rush, and after a couple of months, she follows him. I don't know if you remember your first love, but I do remember my first love. It was a madness. I mean, I was a lunatic for a couple of years. And I think that that is pretty much what happens with young women who fall in love so madly. And the more romantic and the more secluded that your life has been, as it was the case with females then, the worse it is. And she falls in love with love, really. And she follows this man to the gold rush. And in the process, what she discovers is that she's in love with freedom. And I realized when I finished the book that I had written a novel about freedom and not a novel about love, as I thought I was writing.
Isabel, can you tell us about Joaquin Murieta?
Joaquin Murieta is a sort of Latin Robin Hood that lives in the memory of California, especially among the Hispanics. He's a legendary figure. There's no proof that he ever existed. After the 49ers came to California, they became a white majority. Before, the people of color were the majority. And Chinese and Hispanics and people from Hawaii and from other places. And then they made laws to take away the mines and the land, especially from the Mexicans and the Chinese, of course. And when these Mexicans and Peruvians and Chileans found themselves deprived of the mines, the gold, and the land, many of them became bandits. And every crime that happened during that time was attributed to someone called Joaquin. It could be Joaquin Valenzuela, it could be Joaquin Murieta, it could be the different Joaquin. Eventually, it all narrowed down to Joaquin Murieta. And he became a sort of legendary character because it is impossible that he would have committed a crime in Los Angeles in the morning and in the afternoon in Sacramento. There were no jets then, so he couldn't have moved from that place to the other. But they offered a reward for his head, and a man called Captain Love and 20 of his men went out. They killed a bunch of Mexicans, and they cut the head of one of them, put it in a jar with alcohol, and they said that that was Joaquin Murieta. But the head was never identified, not even by members of the supposedly Joaquin Murieta's family. So we don't know if he existed or not, if that was his head or not. So he's a perfect character for a novel, because I can do anything I want with him, and no historian can come afterwards and say, no, you were not accurate with this or that. So it was perfect. And I used, of course, the fact that Eliza's lover is called Joaquin Andieta to play with a name, and later he can be or not Joaquin Murieta.
You also have the figure of Miss Rose in Daughter of Fortune. Tell us a little about her.
I love Miss Rose. Miss Rose is a Victorian spinster who has a double life, a secret life. And I think that most of the characters in this book, in spite of me, because I didn't plan it that way, come up with secret lives. They start, for example, the book starts with a man called Jacob Todd, who everybody thinks is a sort of missionary, and he is just a guy who lost a bet, and he's selling Bibles because he lost a bet. So everything is like veiled and disguised, and people have masks and disguises, and Eliza needs to dress as a man. First she's a Chinese boy, then she's a cowboy, a Hispanic cowboy. So everybody has a secret garden inside them. And Miss Rose, I don't want to give it away, but she also has a double personality, and I love that. The other thing that she does.
I don't want to give it away either, but I have to say, I thought it was very interesting earlier, and I don't know why this popped into my head when you talked about your maternal family thinking about you as writing pornography. Has your relationship changed to your Latin American audience now writing from the United States?
Yes, because I don't live in Latin America, and although my books are published in Spanish first, and I get most of my letters in Spanish, I don't live there. I find that my stories have changed. Even the way I write has changed. I write in shorter sentences, less adjectives, in a less baroque way. I find that the stories are more universal and less Latin, maybe. However, Daughter of Fortune has been number one in the bestseller list in Spain and in Latin America. And even if it's a story about California, people identify with the story in Spanish-speaking countries because the story is very American, but it is told from the perspective of an immigrant.
And with your increased celebrity, your tremendous celebrity around the world, how has that changed your ability to gather stories? Because you have become such a prominent figure. Can you sit back? Can you just observe things going unnoticed?
First of all, I have three grandchildren who keep me grounded. I don't believe the celebrity stuff, and I'm very humble about myself because I have these people around me who are always pulling me down. And my mother also, by the way.
Isabel Allende has been our guest for this hour, author of House of the Spirits, Eva Luna, Paula of Love and Shadows, her latest book, Daughter of Fortune. I hope you've enjoyed the hour. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director from the studios of WBAI in New York. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.